This week on Your Western Context, Dr. Hinshaw apologizes for the misreporting of COVID deaths. A new OECD agreement puts Trudeau's big tech tax on hold, and many still trapped in Afghanistan wait for Canadian help. Also, Horgan's delay of the Massey Tunnel replacement could cost BC. This is Western Context, episode 240, recorded Friday, October 15th, 2021. A Bridge to Nowhere. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back this week, and we have a whole lot of news to discuss, some very unfortunate news out of Alberta, and some local Vancouver news as well.
Yes, indeed. Lots of news to talk about this week that kind of flew in under the radar. It's another quiet week in the sense that there's no big news story that's kind of taken over. But there's been a lot of smaller stories that have not really got the attention that they deserve, despite their far-reaching implications. So that's what we're here to do, is to talk about those stories and to try and shed a bit more light on what's going on in the country.
That's right. And if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to remove all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media, on print, online, TV, anywhere you consume your news. And in removing that bias and sensationalism, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And you can follow along with us in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. And of course, if you like what you hear and you want to support the podcast, you can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/westerncontext. We're starting off in Alberta this week with a story that raised a lot of eyebrows earlier in the week and was initially coined fake news, but it's something that everybody should be aware of, in particular in terms of how the media covered it. And we talk about this because COVID has been a disease that has been completely upended what the media has been talking about for about 18 months now. And there's been a continual moving target due to new information coming in and the constant change in what the guidelines have been and what people have been recommended to do has led to an erosion of trust within the media and other sources that would otherwise be deemed trustworthy in a global pandemic. And this is, of course, amplified by the media's fear tactics that they have been using since day one of reporting daily case counts with daily deaths, and the impact that this has on anyone hearing this for almost daily for 18 months cannot be understated. And we talk about this in a very abstract way, and the media reports it as such that they're just numbers on the screen. But in reality, when someone internalizes it, it works on their internal psyche and creates a sense of fear that the media may or may not know that they're willingly perpetrating throughout the entirety of the population with this. And that's why it's always important when the numbers, the daily numbers, have been reported in the media to take them with a grain of salt and make sure that what's being reported is actually what happened that week. And that's why this week the media and those in the NDP opposition collectively gasped and reeled at the news of a 14-year-old boy dying from COVID here in Alberta. But what actually happened was that 14-year-old Nathaniel Spitzer died of a brain tumor that he had been fighting for 9 months. The doctors didn't even give Nathaniel 9 months to live. They gave him 5 or 6. Yes, half the time that he actually lived. Now, the family involved does not want this 9-month cancer fight overlooked because of the COVID pandemic. And in the final days of Nathaniel's life, he did test positive for COVID, and as a result, his death was erroneously classed as a COVID death. Now, this bothered the family tremendously. The family said, it's not like he had all this time that was taken away from him. The most important thing was that for the family to say that, as they called him, Natty, to not have the death of their son classed as a COVID fatality. To them, they see this as the government writing them off. When presenting data to the public, Dr. Deanna Hinshaw said this includes the death of a 14-year-old who had complex pre-existing medical conditions that played a significant role in their death. But earlier this week on Thursday, Dr. Henshaw apologized, saying that the pain of losing a child is terrible enough without having that loss compounded by a public debate about the circumstances. I'm sorry if the way I spoke about that death made your grief worse. And this, of course, is also leading to changes in the way that Alberta reports COVID deaths for anyone under the age of 18. If anybody under the age of 18 dies who is thought to have died from COVID, that death will not be announced until a full review has been undertaken. And they will also be prioritizing accuracy over timeliness. And this is a very key part of the story, because you hear accuracy over timeliness, and you ask the question in your head, okay, if they're prioritizing that, what does that mean for everybody else? Well, it means for the deaths in the pandemic so far, they have been prioritizing the timeliness in getting the results out in the interest of public transparency. And in the past, there's been a great push for the province to ensure that every death in every case is reported accurately, as they should. We all know that without the appropriate data backing up some of these decisions that are made, you can't make good decisions. In this case, there was a social media groundswell around the family centered on independent media outlets, and typically these calls that the media get it right and that COVID death numbers might be overflated are simply passed off as fake news by the mainstream media. And it wasn't until the independent media started asking questions later in the week that the mainstream media actually paid attention to this and the provincial government issued a correction. But the important thing for every listener of Western Context and your friends out there to listen, and if you're going to take one thing to your friends or one thing that you might be talking to somebody about the news with over the next week or so, it's this. It's important to remember that all fake news and all media bias has a basis in reality. And too many times, the media does not do their job in asking all the questions. Now, when I heard that a 14-year-old had passed away, my eyebrows were raised, because young people are extraordinarily resilient to COVID, and even more so if they've had a vaccine. And there should always be an extra layer of skepticism and questions from the media when anyone under 18 dies for any reason. It doesn't make the death less tragic, but it shows the external dynamics that are in play here. Now, just pivoting from this slightly, the province also reported 30 deaths on Thursday, October 14th, and some media outlets reported this as 30 deaths within the last 24 hours, but all they had to do was listen to Dr. Henshaw's daily statement to learn that these deaths actually took place between October 7th and October 13th. And it's at this point we say that there's a big difference between 30 deaths in one day and 30 deaths over 6 days. Before we leave Alberta here, I also have to tell you about CBC Edmonton story and them being caught by Reuters Fact Check this week. A news report that was produced by CBC Edmonton that was discussing modeling and projections of the pandemic did garner some media attention, because it appears as though that in the report that they were actually using mannequins in the ICU. And this led to the idea that, well, if there's room for a mannequin in a story about modeling that is deemed to be filmed today, it might not be very busy in the ICU. And this story took off on social media. Now, Reuters correctly reported that there was missing context, as when CBC Edmonton was contacted, they said that they used the wrong footage when discussing projections and modeling, and the footage they used initially came from a story of in the last month about how an ICU works. CBC Edmonton issued an apology, but the damage to the media trust was done on all fronts this week, and that's why context in the media is so important.
Yes, it's very interesting how we saw two very, very different stories about COVID-19 make its way to the media, and yet they get reported on so incorrectly. One, the very tragic death of a teenager fighting brain cancer, and the other, footage of a ICU where a whole host of medical professionals seem to be working on mannequins. And if you don't pay attention to the news, such things you could just gloss over and your brain will automatically accept them as being true, because a lot of people that don't think critically about the news will look at news report and just assume that it's rooted in fact, because obviously people wouldn't be taking falsehoods and putting them on the news, right? But that is in case that is exactly what actually happens in many different cases in Canada, which is why we have to look so critically at what we're watching on the news and what we're learning about. And in this particular case, the tragic death of Nathaniel Spitzer, you know, objections actually came about because of Facebook and the family members posting on Facebook that this was not a death from COVID, that it was indeed a death from inoperable brain tumor that could not be mitigated in any way. And you know, this is something that's where a lot of fake news story starts out as Facebook, but it should be remembered that a lot of true things start from independent media outlets like Western Context and a lot of other news sources that may not be verified correctly right away. So that's why we have to be careful to really discern what we look at and to try and figure out what the actual truth is, and why we have to use our own brains with that as well, because we clearly can't rely on publications like CBC Edmonton in using fake footage or you know, the other outlets who reported on Nathaniel Spitzer's death to actually get the stories right the first go, because we have to think about exactly what is going on and to find out what the real truth is.
Yeah, and that's exactly the thing. It comes down to real truth, and every bit of fake news out there is grounded in that. And there's always a discussion going on, and this is very, very true in the U.S., just in terms of how some of the states were reporting their COVID numbers, is that they were including people who died with COVID as COVID deaths rather than somebody who succumbed to primary causes of COVID. And we need to be very careful here and hope that nobody in Canada is reporting on that path. I know that supporters of the UCP government have held the premier and his health minister to account on that, and it's come up in, I think, pretty much every Q&A that the premier has done this year, with the town hall style Q&As, that is, online with the supporters, that, you know, are you actually counting numbers of people who died from COVID as opposed to people who just died with COVID? So that's something that is in the mind of the Alberta government, but they didn't get it right this time. And it's important to always have this rubric out front going forward to make sure that, you know, we are counting the numbers correctly, because, you know, they are numbers, and on their own numbers can't hurt anyone. But when they're applied in a various way, they can influence so many things. And we do that here as well. We look at the numbers, we look at everything related to the stories, and we've been doing that since January of 2017. And we would love your support. You can check it out at patreon.com/westerncontext. There we offer 3 tiers of support if you want to help us support the podcast. For as little as $2 a month, you can help us remove the bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the show if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. And we're, of course, here still waiting for Parliament to return. We're waiting for the new cabinet to be sworn in. We know that Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland will stay on as finance, but that's about all we know. The Trudeau government is taking its sweet time in building a cabinet after the election, more time than most government transitions take. But we do have some news in relation to the big tech tax that was campaigned on during the election.
Yes, Canada will now be delaying the implementation of the Liberals' digital services tax, which is one of the signature promises of their election platform, and they may actually have to abandon it altogether after the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development reached a deal on a multilateral tax approach in dealing with tech companies. Now, the OECD, for those who don't know, is made up of high-income countries that are dedicated to democracy and the market economy. These are countries like the United States, Canada, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, Israel, much of Western Europe, as well as Japan and South Korea, along with a few countries in Central America and some in South America. Now, the agreement spans further than just OECD member countries, though. The agreement by 136 countries sets a global minimum corporate tax rate of 15% for multinational companies. Now, this will also require the largest and most profitable global companies, those with global sales above about $28.7 billion a year and more than 10% profitability, to pay some taxes in countries where they operate, even if they don't have a physical presence there, which refers to many tech companies. Now, the OECD deal aims to end a four-decade-long race to the bottom by setting a floor for countries that have sought to attract investment and jobs by taxing multinational companies lightly, effectively allowing them to shop around for low tax rates. But in exchange, OECD countries will have to remove or hold off on implementing their own digital services taxes. Now, that includes Canada's promise tax on tech giants targeted at large companies that operate online marketplaces, social media platforms, and earn revenue from online advertising. So companies like Amazon, Google, and Facebook, as well as Uber and Airbnb, if they also meet minimum revenue criteria, would be covered by the tax. Now, the Canadian government had estimated that this plan would bring in about $3.4 billion over 5 years. Now, the Office of Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland, who will continue to remain the Deputy Prime Minister following the cabinet shuffle, as you mentioned, she said that the Liberal government will delay the implementation of the digital services tax from January 1st, 2022 to January 1st, 2024. Now, the Canadian DST, as it's called, would only come into effect if the OECD agreement hasn't come into force by 2024. But if the Canadian tax is implemented, it would be retroactive. Freeland said in a statement, quote, "In that event, the DST would be payable as of 2024 in respect of revenues earned as of January 1st, 2022. It is our sincere hope that the timely implementation of the new international system will make this unnecessary." Now, the delay is due to a section of the OECD agreement that requires, quote, "all parties to remove all digital services taxes and other relevant similar measures with respect to all companies, and to commit to not introduce such measures in the future." Countries can't impose any new digital services taxes until at least the end of 2023 or until the new agreement is in force. Now, whether the tax will affect other initiatives that the Liberal government has promised to implement to take on big tech is less clear. The Liberals have pledged to introduce, within 100 days of Parliament's return, both legislation aimed at forcing companies like Netflix to pay into the Canadian content system, and legislation following the Australian model that would see Google and Facebook compensate news outlets for their content. Now, these commitments relate to corporate tax measures and not to regulatory actions of government in areas such as broadcasting and content licensing, and this is under the OECD agreement, which was talked about when asked whether those would count as other relevant measures. Now, unfortunately, it remains to be seen what effect this will have on consumers of digital content, which is pretty much everyone these days. The media hasn't delved too deep into what these governmental tax measures actually mean for ordinary citizens and just how much these things will cost us at the end of the day. Now, because tax increases aren't exactly attention-grabbing, these consequences will seemingly fly under the radar unless something appears later on. However, they are still important to talk about because they could have far-reaching impacts on not just the economy, but also how we do business and how we consume content.
And the interesting thing when you look at this is that you're looking at a minimum tax rate of 15% corporate tax. And there has been that race to the bottom. There has been a great attraction of tech companies to Ireland because Ireland has always had a low corporate tax. And people wonder why Apple's headquarters for Europe is in Ireland. Well, it's because of that tax rate. So what this effectively does, and this is potentially one of the economic issues we're going to see after this implements it after a few years, is that yes, countries like Canada can go further and have a higher corporate tax rate if they want. The US has a higher corporate tax rate as well. And the thing that people are not realizing with this is that this effectively moves the 0% tax mark from 0 up to 15. And as a result of that, you're going to have exactly the same things that people were trying to prevent with this happening at 15%. And the only real action that comes from this, in terms of just having a minimum tax floor with this, is that this money just goes and makes governments bigger in all the countries where these tech companies operate and get a portion of it. And the other really interesting thing with this is that countries like Canada will still be free to pursue content regulation. And we all know that in the last parliament, that was one of the biggest things that came up from Stephen Guilbeault and his friends. And that will likely happen and will still be an issue with this. And the way the corporations are going to look at this is that, well, this evens the playing field amongst countries. Nothing really has changed. Let's just still shop around and figure out who's, you know, putting their taxes up a couple of percentage points above 15 and go there.
Yeah, exactly. And it also doesn't apply to any of the countries that didn't sign on to the agreement as well. So we might even see some tech companies try to set up shop in other countries outside of the agreement. And that's another consideration that is being levied towards the agreement by the OECD, is that it's not that it doesn't have enough power, or that it doesn't really have enough teeth to really enforce what it's trying to do, and which is to level the playing field and to stop other countries from having an artificially low tax rate to stop these tech companies from going to those places. So, it remains to be seen what it'll actually have an impact on in Canada, because Canada generally has a much higher tax rate than the global average. And this is something that will likely continue even with this agreement. So we'll have to see what this remains for consumers, because at the end of the day, the Trudeau Liberals did say they were going to try and change how the country works with big tech companies. And this will probably not really affect what they're going to do with the Canadian content system, with trying to force big tech companies to compensate Canadian consumers and Canadian creators, rather, of Canadian culture. And this is something that has been going on for a few years now. And as you mentioned, Stephen Guilbeault is likely still going to be at the helm of this. And we'll have to see if the election has changed anything in that regard, but likely not. And the media hasn't really been reporting on this story very much, so we're still in the dark, but we'll keep track of the story as it moves forward and as more consequences become known.
Yeah, unearthing consequences and talking about just things that have been entirely missed is what we do here at Western Context. And we started off the election campaign in late August talking about the consequences of Afghanistan. And that started with a scene of chaos at the Kabul airport and ended with people falling off the sides of a plane. And the situation in Afghanistan has become an issue yet again. And that's because here still in October, we have Canadians that are waiting to be evacuated from that country, and they are needing to move through Pakistan in order to make that possible. We saw photos of Canadians waiting to be evacuated lined up at the Kabul airport when everything was happening there in late August. They were standing knee-deep in sewage, but the military evacuation never came. And now, as I mentioned, Pakistan is the way out, and through that, they are forced to take an intricate web of roadways through Afghanistan into Pakistan, passing Taliban checkpoints, and then passing a Pakistan border checkpoint. And with that, then only can they begin to fly back home or fly directly to Canada if they're refugees. And the story that falls behind this is that actually Pakistan, one of the international airlines that was permitted to operate out of Kabul, has stopped flights. So now the road is the only way out. And families that are left behind are forced to run cover for those who are leaving to Canada, saying that those who are on their way out or might be in different parts of the country on business, and this has been reported numerous times. By the estimate of the Canadian military, there were 10,000 Afghans who helped the military and wanted to come to Canada. A few hundred have been extracted, and 1,700 remain in Kabul, who are slated to be airlifted to Canada. There was also, of course, the promise of the Trudeau Liberals during the campaign to resettle 40,000 Afghan refugees. They've approved 9,400, and just under a quarter of those have actually arrived in Canada. But time and time again, with all these cases, the problem is the situation on the ground. Spokesperson Peter Liang said that the most significant challenge is the extreme volatility of the situation on the ground and ever-changing circumstances around the documentation required at checkpoints and international crossings, which make it exceedingly difficult to get Afghan refugees safely out of the country now that it is under control of the Taliban. Now, of course, if we look at what was not reported in the Canadian media and was reported in American outlets, it was actually said that the Taliban offered control of Kabul to the U.S. military before they withdrew. This would have allowed a couple of extra crucial days for international flights to operate, keeping Kabul as a safe zone, and the military flights would have also been able to continue uninterrupted. The U.S. also gave up Bagram Air Base, leaving behind tons of military hardware, things like helicopters, tanks, and trucks. And there are lots of people in the U.S. who want to go either get those back or destroy them so that they can't be used to harm Western allies. But, of course, those who are actually left behind, the people actually left behind, are in a parallel or in a perilous situation if actually discovered and await a horrible fate. A former interpreter for the Canadian forces, Nasir Khwaja, managed to flee to Canada in August, but his brother did not get out. On August 15th, his brother was abducted by the Taliban, who also happened to work for U.S. and British troops, and was placed next to an explosive-laden vehicle, which was detonated, and this was his punishment by the Taliban for helping U.S. forces. Another former Afghan employee that worked for the Canadian forces, Muhammad Ismail, detailed his journey from Kandahar to Kabul and eventually out of the country, having to make the trip to Kabul twice. He did get out of the country through Pakistan. And in Pakistan, there were multiple checkpoints that were set up and then a stay in an Islamabad hotel before he flew off to Canada. And it wasn't just him, of course. There were several others who helped the Western forces in the 20-year-long war who made their way out of Afghanistan through Pakistan. Now, the important thing to note about this story is this story just showcases a handful of cases of what the withdrawal of forces in Afghanistan created and the way that was shepherded through. A withdrawal that saw a few Canadian forces exfiltrated and then the country ultimately fell to chaos. This was an issue that started late in the summer election campaign and faded away about 10 days after. But at the end of the day, this shows why a principled approach from Canada and our allies was needed through the very end. And despite the fact that this has disappeared in the eyes of our government, our defense agencies, and the media, it shows that it's still happening there, and Canadians need to be aware of just what's happening and what's not being reported by the media in this story.
Yes, exactly. The story is what started almost at the exact same time as the election campaign. And it wasn't something that was really outside of the Canadian consciousness for a good number of weeks there, because we would hear about how the Taliban were advancing and they were taking over cities and checkpoints and roads much quicker than the West certainly were hoping that they would, or that they were thinking that they would. And this led to mass panic in Kabul and other areas of the country. And a lot of people that had helped the Canadian forces through either through interpreter work or through civilian contracting, you know, a lot of these people were left behind after the Canadian forces left, and after the U.S.-led withdrawal happened, there were a lot of these people that were left behind after the takeover of the airport. And it just remains to be seen what exactly Canada is going to be doing for these people that had helped the Canadian government in such a way that they should have been taken care of first. But, you know, we're still hearing stories about people trapped over in Afghanistan. We're hearing about what is happening to the country. And I think that Canadians are still not comfortable with how the whole situation was handled. And, you know, for an election campaign to be called right at a time when a strong government response was needed most, you know, it's just another reason why the Trudeau Liberals were tone deaf in calling an early election when they did.
Yeah, and it really also shows that I don't know whether it was a issue of intelligence and things weren't reported correctly to the government, or if they just felt as though that the bureaucracy would be able to handle it, or then, you know, maybe the Canadian public just wouldn't care, because Canadians do have a reputation in all of the campaigns that we undertake of really not focusing that much on foreign policy and the like. But we, of course, need to realize that you talk to any Canadian, and this is a story that gets missed a lot, and things in the country need to happen in order to see this come to the forefront. But Canadians in general are very patriotic and want to see Canada do the right thing. And if we're not doing that right thing, well, then questions need to be asked about just why that's the case. And that didn't happen in the election campaign. Of course, everybody was more concerned with local issues about things such as what guns were going to be banned, what guns were not going to be banned, or maybe if Aaron O'Toole hit an agenda, when, of course, the discussion should have been on the substantive issues like inflation, cost of living, and, of course, these issues of principled foreign policy. But it wasn't. And it shows how nobody in that campaign was able to drive the media coverage in the correct way. And that's why we're still talking about this story. But we're going to move on to BC right now, which is a bit of a departure in terms of where we normally book the firing line of the show. But it definitely makes sense to talk about some things happening in BC, because this could have also become an election campaign issue in the Metro Vancouver area.
Yes, indeed. This is a story talking about Metro Vancouver, which in the last election had quite a big change in how politics were viewed and which politicians were actually elected to the legislature. And, well, not long after the 2017 BC election had engineered a result in such a way that allowed the BC NDP to take power not too long after, it presented a change for how the province was administered. Suddenly, necessary infrastructure projects that were underway after being greenlit by the previous BC Liberal government were now facing a threat of being cancelled. Now, one of which was, of course, the Site C Dam near Fort St. John, which we've mentioned many times before. The Liberals were confident that even if they didn't win the election, that the amount of construction and money put forward already would lead to an astronomical waste if the incoming NDP decided to cancel it. And in the end, John Horgan did say that construction would continue, much to his own personal regret. Now, another infrastructure project that badly needed to get off the ground was the replacement for the over 60-year-old Massey Tunnel, which was a major transportation artery that provides a vital route for automotive traffic underneath the Fraser River in between Delta and Richmond in Metro Vancouver. Now, I previously talked about the Massey Tunnel back on Western Context 33 way back in 2017. Now, since then, there's been some news on the matter that will not shock anyone who knows about government inaction, decision reversals, and budget overruns. Now, this was a replacement project going back decades. In early 2006, it was reported that the provincial government had plans to expand the tunnel's capacity from 4 lanes to 6 because increasing numbers of traffic and a higher number of population and a greater number of people commuting into the city from the suburbs meant that the tunnel was getting overworked to its capacity and that there was going to be huge congestion problems if something wasn't done. So 15 years ago, it was known that the tunnel was going to be needing to be replaced. Now, originally, that capacity extension was not actually followed through with, and the tunnel remained 4 lanes only because just a few years later, in September 2012, it was decided that the tunnel itself would need to be replaced completely. Now, then Premier Kirsty Clark announced plans to replace the aging tunnel within 10 years, which address in order to address the congestion and the safety issues that were currently plaguing the structure. Now, originally, the work was going to be completed at a cost of $3.5 billion, and work began a year later on plans for a new bridge to replace the tunnel, and environmental assessments took a few years to receive approval, as they normally do for these big projects, and in early 2017, the project cleared all the necessary bureaucratic and environmental hurdles, and the bridge was to begin construction that year. Now, the bridge that was going to be replaced, replacing the tunnel, was going to have a 10-lane bridge, and it was going to have 5 lanes each way, and it was going to outlast the Massey Tunnel by quite a number of years, and it was going to have enough capacity that it would be able to serve Metro Vancouver for many decades to come. Now, in comes the May 2017 election, which resulted in a change of power. John Horgan ended up scrapping the project in favor of a solution with more research and consultation with the Metro Vancouver mayors, who were originally opposed to the BC Liberals' 10-lane bridge plan. On October 2nd of 2019, the Metro Vancouver mayors finally recommended a new 8-lane tunnel as the replacement of the Massey Tunnel. And earlier this summer, in August, the BC government announced the go-ahead of the new 8-lane tunnel, which was being subject to Indigenous consultation and environmental approvals, which still need to go forward. Now, benefits of the tunnel versus the bridge are claimed to be less visual and agricultural land impact, less elevation change for cyclists and long-haul truckers, as well as rain cover for cyclists and pedestrians, and will allow bottlenecked improvements to begin immediately on Highway 99 approaches on either side of the river. Now, the toll-free tunnel is scheduled for completion in 2030 with a projected cost of $4.15 billion, which you might note is actually $650 million higher than the original estimate of the bridge replacement, which, had it gotten worked on earlier, would have gotten finished much earlier. Now, the NDP have finally released the much-delayed business case to justify replacing the aging Massey Tunnel with the 8-lane tunnel instead of a bridge. But true to form, in posting the 100-plus page document on the Transportation Ministry website, the government has actually blanked out details that would actually let us really see the validity of the NDP's plan and to actually judge whether or not they made the right decision in canceling the earlier bridge plan from the BC Liberals. Now, the current business plan provides no basis to really fairly assess the cost comparison between the tunnel and the bridge options because all of the numbers that would allow one to do so were actually suppressed in the version released to the public. Now, in greenlighting the replacement project back in August, the government claimed a $70 million advantage for the tunnel, $4.15 billion as the all-in construction cost, versus what they figured was $4.22 billion for the bridge. But you know, in doing so, you have to forget that on taking an office in 2017, the New Democrats canceled the BC Liberal plan to build more bridge, which was 10 lanes, for less money, which was $3.5 billion. And they actually also wrote off $100 million that had already been spent. Now, among the numbers blacked out were the itemized cost breakdowns for constructing the new 8-lane tunnel and burying the sections at the bottom of the Fraser River, building the roadworks at either end, and removing the existing tunnel when the new one is finished. Likewise, the comparable breakdowns for the 8-lane bridge were also blanked out from the business case, and also blanked were the value for money analysis, the contingency budgets, interest during construction, the projected inflation rate, and the budget for property acquisition. So these are a whole bunch of things that are a big deal for such a large infrastructure project. And for us to not know any details surrounding it, it does remain a mystery as to whether this will actually be a good deal or not. Now, the NDP also intend that the tunnel will be built under one of their project benefit agreements, which favors the union labor and benefits. But they also blocked out the percentage estimate for what that requirement will add to the cost of construction. Also shrouded in secrecy are passages discussing project risks and what potential downfalls of the project could occur. Now, the business case does concede that, quote, the delivery of the immersed tube tunnel has a greater risk profile than the bridge crossing, but that admission is then followed by a sentence of perhaps two dozen words that is completely blanked out, leaving the actual risk profile a mystery. Now, another passage about the risks are equally nebulous. This is straight from the document itself, which has blanked out portions as to what is actually going on. For instance, quote, a total of blank risks were quantified for the risk analysis. Of these, blank differentiate among the procurement options being analyzed, and blank are material, but apply equally to all procurement options. So it's clear that the redacted parts of the cost assessment are not there for safety reasons or to protect the economic interests of the province, but that it's purely for political reasons. Having killed the Liberal proposal for a 10-lane toll bridge, the New Democrats were not really going to come back 4 years later and admit that the bridge, albeit toll-free, smaller, and costing more money, was actually the right decision after all. Now, South Delta BC Liberal MLA Ian Patton, who is one of the main architects of the bridge project in the first place, feels vindicated. He said, quote, we always said that the bridge was a perfect answer and the bridge would be opening literally a year from now if we'd kept the bridge project going. The public in BC needs to know where we're going with this. We need to know what the figures are and what taxpayers are going to be paying for this. Now, the 10-lane version had already passed environmental approval and permitting when the BC Liberals were left office in 2017. The business case indicates that the tunnel actually faces another 4 years of environmental approval, consultations, feedback, and permitting with provincial and federal authorities before a hoped-for start of construction that's going to take place in 2026, which is almost an entire decade after the previous plan would have started. Now, the NDP jump-started approval for the replacement project in the first week of the national election campaign in the summer in hopes of lining up funding commitments from the federal parties, but Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole weighed in with an endorsement of the new plan, as did Liberal Cabinet Minister Carla Qualtrough, but neither party committed to a specific share of the funding. And as we've seen from many projects in the past that are looking for federal funding, well, if the federal Liberals do decide to commit to some funding, it will likely be well short of 50% of the cost. And if Ottawa follows past practice, the dollar amount will actually be capped, which ensures that the province alone will be on the hook for inevitable budget overruns. So in any event, the replacement project is still a long way from the start of construction, never mind the finish, and it's estimated that the tunnel will be completed in 2030 at the earliest. for Metro Vancouver commuters stewing in their cars waiting for their turn in the tunnel to get over to the other parts of Vancouver. That translates into another 9 years of delays and frustration. Now, had the previous proposal gone through, the new 10-lane bridge would have likely been completed by now or in the very near future. Horgan's government is now 4 years into power, and we're likely to see many more decisions like these cost BC more time and more money. The only thing remaining is to find out what exactly they are.
And the really interesting thing when you look at this story is that this is one of those cases where people look at the cost of a huge infrastructure project and press pause because they don't like how much it costs and they want to come up with a different alternative, or maybe the circumstances have changed in terms of what is environmentally or socially acceptable. But the thing that this underscores is that by undertaking that delay, the cost of the project will go up. And if we're looking to build these things as quickly as possible, the provincial jurisdictions need to have a regulatory regime where if a project needs to be built and it is in the public interest, that process needs to be streamlined. And that's something that Alberta is working on. It's something that BC should work on. But at the end of the day, if an infrastructure project has to be built, it's better to build it quick at a lower cost than keep diddling all the way down to the end of another 10 plus years. And at this point, if this project is slated to start in 2026, the only thing that might get it complete for the 2030 deadline is a potential Vancouver 2030 Winter Olympics bid.
Yes, indeed. And certainly we've seen infrastructure projects like this that get ballooned and they don't start right away, or they have to take more time for environmental risk assessments. All it does is it ends up inflating the cost of the projects itself, because not only do wages go up, but the price of materials goes up, the cost of securing them goes up, and really it just ends up being so much more than what it was before. And every year that this project was delayed meant that the price was going up. And the NDP knew this when they took power and they canceled the project right away. And yet they still went ahead in doing so because they wanted to be politically right. But as we see from the business case here, a lot of these numbers are blanked out and we don't actually know whether it was the right decision or not, despite being 4 years later on the issue. And so we might not even see these numbers be unredacted until the project itself is completed and we find out at the end of the day whether it was a good deal or not. And by then, likely the Horgan NDP government won't be in power anymore. He won't be the premier anymore, and it'll be a new government altogether. So that's why it's so troublesome for provinces to be able to get these big infrastructure projects done, because governments don't really govern for the long term. They govern for the short term, and they do what they have to try and stay in power. Well, you know, for when we're looking decades down the line, that's going to be something that not really many governments are going to be looking towards, because they know that it's not going to provide them any immediate impact. So what they're doing here with blanking out all of these risk assessments and the business cases is they're trying to hide what the risk actually was, because even though it was 4 years ago, they're still in power. And, well, you know, this was the decision that the NDP made. They can't blame the BC Liberals for any problems with the project, because unlike Site C, this is all on the NDP. And whether it goes well or not, this is what they will have to live with.
And that's the consequences of government at the end of the day. People vote with their conscience. They vote emotionally based on how they feel about a certain policy plank. But at the end of the day, that change in government completely can change what we're looking at in terms of these projects. And for many, that's a bridge that they've never crossed. And I think with that, we can go on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is actually bridge, which is defined as a structure or idea that makes it easier to traverse two differing landscapes, either physically or communicatively. So there's either the physical bridge, which would have been put in place in this particular area, which in other parts of the Lower Mainland, you can definitely see many other bridges that have made it a lot easier to get across Metro Vancouver with its many rivers. But bridges can also be used in a metaphorical sense, and in where two people or two different ideas come together and allow them to work more harmoniously. So bridges are something that is very useful in society, both in the physical sense, but also in a more mindscape sense as well.
Yeah, and you know, that's perfectly fine. And it was interesting talking about BC in the sense of a firing line, because this is a story that in the grand scheme of things, if you're outside of BC or even the greater Vancouver area, you might think of as not being that important to you. But if you're a BCer, it's definitely important. It shows the consequences of elections. It shows the way the NDP is governing itself and hiding so much. And for everybody outside of BC, it's a good example of what can happen with complex engineering projects when they're not undertaken in a timely manner and you have a change in government. And that just goes to show why, if something is important to build, that it be built. And we talked a lot about this, and we talked a lot about news that wasn't covered this week, and all that and more can be found in our supplementals and full show notes at westerncontext.ca. We also have the podcast available on any number of podcast listeners out there, which you can find at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, many, many more. And of course, we're also on social media, on Twitter and Facebook, where you can find us at Western Context. We share the shows and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entirety of the week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always be sure to look through all the stories that the media talks about, a lot that they don't talk about, and in a sense, to talk about news before the mainstream media even tries to report on them. And we try and look through all these stories, whether you find them on radio, TV, print, or online, and we'll give you the context from those stories, put you on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.